In 1984, Geraldine Ferrara made history. As the first woman to be nominated for Vice President of the United States, she forever reshaped the American political and social landscape. In her acceptance speech, she spoke of herself as the realization of the American dream. Tonight, she said, the daughter of an immigrant from Italy has been chosen to run for Vice President in the new land my father came to love. In her new memoir entitled Framing a Life, she tells the story of her family's immigrant experience and how it shaped her life. The book is published by Scribner, and I am very pleased that it brings Geraldine Ferrara back to New York and Company today. Hello.
Hi.
In this election year, some people might have expected a book about politics from you, something more on the order of a public statement rather than a private one.
Actually, the book was something I started in 1990. At least I started in my head. It was when I had taken my mother to the hospital. She was in this previous fall. I took her in, and we were waiting in the emergency room for her to be checked in. And as we were sitting there, nurse came up to me and she said, could you give me some information? And I said, sure. And so she went through the form, you know, what's her name, what's her address, and all the rest of the stuff. And then she got to, and what's her Medicare number? And I said, I don't know. I said, why don't you just ask her? And because my mother was sitting there talking to my husband. And she said, oh, does she understand? And I said, of course she does. I said, her body is falling apart, but her mind is just fine. And so she walked over to my mother and she asked her Medicare number. She went through a whole bunch of other things. And then she said to her, which is something I'd never heard before, she said, did you graduate from high school? And my mother said, no, but I graduated from elementary school. She did it very quickly. And then she looked down after a pause and she said, big deal, huh? And I must tell you that it is the first time that I ever looked at my mother and saw that she was almost embarrassed. And I didn't realize that she had gone through life feeling embarrassed because she had not graduated eighth. She had graduated eighth grade, but no more. And so I went over and I put my arms around her. I was ready to die. I felt so awful. I put my arms around her and I said, you better believe it's a big deal. I said, do you know anybody else in this country, male or female, who has gone to Harvard, to Princeton, Yale? You name the college. And she knew them because my kids had gone to those schools. I said, do you know any of them who have gone to those schools and can walk around and say, my daughter ran for Vice President of the United States? And she smiled. But I decided then, and when she passed away the following February, that I was going to write a book that talked about the fact that she was a big deal and why she was a big deal. So that's what the story is about. It's a story about my grandmother who came here when she was 15 and who could sign her name only with an X. To my mother, who was allowed to go to eighth grade but no further because she had to go support younger brothers and sisters. To me, that my mother really, she was widowed when she was 39 with two kids, worked very hard on a beating frame, thus the name of the title, Framing a Life. I worked in a beating frame to send me and my brother through school and to college and law school. I went to law school. I mean, I went to law school at night and I taught during the day, but I had scholarships. It would not have happened if she hadn't done it. And so that's what the book is about. It's a bouquet to my mother and to a lot of other immigrant women and children of immigrant women who do these things.
You see yourself as being defined by the women in your family who've come before and after?
Very much so. And people have asked, you know, my son, when he saw the book, because, you know, it's on the cover, it's my grandmother, it's me and my mother, it's my two daughters and my granddaughter. And he looked at me and said, so where Dad and I, are we going to be on the back cover? And I laughed and I said, the next book will be about you two guys and my wonderful Matthew, my grandson. But actually, the reason I do it with the women is because they were the ones who influenced my life. My grandfather, I never knew. He died before I was born. My father died when I was 8, and it was actually his death that shaped my life in a lot of ways.
Well, he was much older than your mother.
Well, he was 7 years, 8 years older than she.
Oh, that's not that much.
No, he was 40. He was young when he died. In fact, he was only 5 years old. He was 7 years old. He was 46 when he died. He died and just turned 46.
And she thought she would never get married because she was so old at 20, 21, 22?
When she was younger, yeah. She was a very, unlike, you know, so many of the young girls of that generation who married because their families put them together. She really wanted to marry for love. And she kept on putting it off. Of course, when she got married, she was almost 22 when she got married. And she was considered almost a spinster. She had worked from the time she was 13 and had saved money, you know, for her dowry. And by that, I mean she'd given it to her mother to save for her dowry. But then when her younger sister, Anna, was 18, she wanted to get married. And my mother went out and bought Anna's dowry with the money that she had saved. So when it came time for my mother, when she did fall in love with my father and did want to get married, she had no dowry.
She came here from a place outside of Naples, as so many people did.
My grandmother did. Yeah. My mother was born here, yeah. Right.
And your mother, as you said, had to leave school after the eighth grade to help support the family. But your father's family was rather well-to-do.
Oh, my father's family came from Marchenese, which is in the Provincia de Gazette, and I do know that you're going to have Arthur Schwartz on after this is over, after we're finished talking. His book focuses a little bit on Marchenese and on Caserta. It's right outside of Naples. And my father's family, my grandfather was his title was geometra, which is engineer. And they owned property. My grandmother was a school teacher. My aunts were all school teachers. The family, a couple of my uncles were doctors. So he came from a family that was a landowner. He had gone to the University of Naples for a year, and then he was a bit of a playboy, wanted to, you know, find his fortune, and his father gave him money, came here. He never went through Ellis Island. It's interesting. I went back and I traced how people arrived, and I thought, you know, I have the Medal of Honor from Ellis Island, and I always thought, this is fabulous. I'm in a place where my grandparents came. None of my grandparents came through Ellis Island, and neither did my father. My grandparents were very poor. My grandmother came from Terra Nova, and I haven't really traced where my grandfather came from, but it was also from the South. They came over in steerage, but when they arrived, my grandfather in 1882, I think, and my grandmother in 1890, they went through a place called Castle Garden, which was before Ellis Island. Uh-huh. New York State used to receive immigrants before the federal government took it over in 1892. And so they didn't even come through Ellis Island. And my father, when he came in 1920, he came in because he came from a family that was well off. He was either in first or second class. And what would happen was the customs people used to go out and meet the ship so that those people never had to be inconvenienced. The only people who went through Ellis Island, unfortunately, were those people who were in steerage.
The poor folks.
Yeah, it was a shame. And they were treated from the very minute they arrived in just a very, very different way.
But this is an odd marriage, something that never would have happened in Italy because of the difference in class and education.
As a matter of fact, when my father married my mother, he provided the dowry, and when they went to Italy, they went after they'd been married about two and a half years. They went over and they brought my brother, who was an infant, like 2 months. He wanted to show his family his new son, and they went over to Italy. And according to his family, they all thought that she had everything that she had was provided by her family. It wasn't. There were, you know, Italy was very, very class conscious at that time. And, you know, they would never have allowed that marriage to happen. Thank God they did. Thank God it happened in the United States.
Car accidents figure very prominently in your family's story, as though there is some sort of curse.
Yeah, it's amazing. My father was injured in a car accident when he was engaged to my mother, and was so badly scarred that he said to her, "Forget it, you don't have to marry me." You know, I mean, that's how bad he looked. Though I think he was a very good-looking man, and to be quite frank, he died when I was so young, I don't remember the scars at all. But my brother Gerard, who was, my brother Carl was the baby who was brought to Italy. He was one of twins. My brother Gerard was born 2 years after Carl. My brother Gerard was killed in an automobile accident on Route 9W, going up to Newburgh, which is where my parents had moved before I was born.
And he was just an infant,
he was 3 years old. It was tragic. My mother had taken him. It was late at night. And I found out when writing the book that they had evidently come down. It was the anniversary of my grandfather's death, and evidently she'd come down to be with her family and her mother. And they were driving back at night, and it was rain, and the automobile accident. It was a head-on collision. He was killed instantly.
You were named after him in a way, weren't you?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. My mother was devastated. I mean, she used to get up, and she used to wash his clothes every day, and then rehang them, iron them, hang them up in the closet. cried constantly, and the doctor told my father, he said, you know, she'll go crazy if she doesn't have another child.
Do you think she wanted another boy to replace him, wind up with you?
You know, everybody thought that, and especially when she named me Geraldine after my brother Gerard, they said, oh, it's a shame it's not a boy, and she was just very excited. I must tell you that my mother used to make my clothes, she used to make my, she used to crochet dresses for me, she used to make Shirley Temple curls on my head. My God, I used to sit. I mean, Shirley Temple was doing all the shows. You know, she was on television in movies. And my mother did my blonde curls exactly the same way, layers of curls. She'd spend hours doing it. I took tap dancing lessons when I was a little girl. You know, I mean, I know how to dance to Hankers Away to today. My closest to my mother. My mother always said, thank God I have a daughter. And when I had my first daughter, my mother said, thank God you have a daughter. Only, you know, the relationship between me and my mother was something I as close as I am to my son, and I adore him, don't get me wrong, but there is a different relationship that mothers have with daughters, especially as they get older.
This is also a story of assimilation, and that changes the relationship as well, because you become the first real American in
the
family.
Right.
And then another tragedy, your father dies, as you said, and you've said that was the dividing line in your life.
Yeah, because, you know, before that I had been raised like Shirley Temple. I mean, I had a room full of dolls. I had 50-some-odd dolls. My mother owned a 5 and 10, so, I mean, she used to order dolls, and I'd get them, you know, I had a stroller. My first picture of me that I can remember as a child, the first Christmas I can remember, was when I was about 4 years old, dragging a stroller that was brown and like beige colored up the steps to my parents' bedroom to show them what Santa Claus had brought me. And they'd probably gone to bed like 2 hours before I got up. But they, I had everything. I was a little princess. We lived in a wonderful home, and all of a sudden my father died. And I remember it was a time when women were taken care of, though my mother did work. My mother owned the 5 and 10. It was a time when women were not told about finances, did not worry about bills, didn't know about, you know, anything. And unfortunately, in many homes today, you find that still women who are homemakers don't know what's going on. I mean, they'll sign forms and they have not a clue. And, it, you know, my father, I think, thought he was being protective. But, you know, that's just not right. And women, I mean, that's one of the things that I've always walked around saying, women should know what's going on in their lives.
Well, it forced you to live on a much different level. But
sure,
I'd hazard a guess that you wouldn't have achieved as much if you had lived the kind of comfortable life that mm-hmm. you had.
You're right. You're exactly right. I was, it didn't take very long for things to kind of fall apart up in Newburgh. My mother had asked my grandmother to come up and stay with us. My grandmother evidently was tired of raising kids. She'd raised 10 of her own, 9 of her own, and my grandmother and my Aunt Sarah, who was a child by my grandfather's first marriage, and had raised, you know, helped raise grandchildren. She had been there, done that. She wasn't about to start with this now. I was the second youngest girl of 29 grandchildren, 27, all these kids. And so I think she just figured enough already. And so she wouldn't come up to Newburgh. So my mother moved down to the South Bronx. I grew up on Longfellow Avenue. And my extended family, my aunt, who was a widow, lived across the street, and her two older daughters were married, living across the street. So it was an extended family, but to go from a home in Newburgh, where I had everything, to going to a small apartment in the South Bronx was really quite a shock.
And then boarding school. But we'll come back to all of that
sure.
after we take a little break here. My guest is Geraldine A. Ferraro. She's written, with the help of Catherine Whitney, a family memoir called Framing a Life. It is published by Scribner. This is Radio New York, AMA 20 WNYC. We're back with Geraldine A. Ferraro, who served as representative to Congress from Queens before she was selected in 1984 to be Walter Mondale's vice presidential running mate. She appeared on the CNN Crossfire show with Pat Buchanan until January of this year when she announced her candidacy for the U.S. Senate. And although that story doesn't appear in this book called Framing a Life, a family memoir, which is published by Scribner, at the end we'll probably talk a bit about that as
sure.
well. But right now we are talking about your life. And to bring us up to date, your father just died, you've moved to the Bronx, and you had to go to boarding school. Why?
Well, because, you know, my mother had the problem that women today have who are in the workforce. She had to go to work. She had to go to support me and my brother. And she had nobody to take care of me. And so it was great that my aunt was across the street, but, you know, she wasn't going to be there for me. I mean, suppose I were sick. She had kids of her own. And so my mother first kept me in boarding school in Newburgh, which is where I had originally been in school as a day student when, before my father died. And then I became very ill and had to leave school, went to parochial school in the Bronx for several months while I was homesick, and it just didn't work. I mean, she just couldn't manage it with her work hours and my school hours.
But boarding school must have cost a lot of money as
well.
Well,
she, I have to tell you, you know what she did? She went up to Marymount, and I went to Marymount Tarrytown. I probably have one of the finest educations that you can find around, especially for a kid who grew up in the South Bronx. What happened was my father, remember my father had come from a family that was well off in Italy. What he had done was he had always invested in property. And the property was income-producing property, but you couldn't bring the income here at that time. You couldn't repatriate the money from Italy. It was right after the war. And so she went to Marymount in Tarrytown, which is where one of my cousins, another cousin, her cousins had gone, and spoke to the nun up there and said, you know, I just don't know how I'm going to pay the tuition. Is there any way she could get a scholarship? Because my marks are very good. And the nun said, well, yeah, we do, but it's a limited amount of money. So she said, is there any other source of income? My mother said, no. She said, well, the only thing is, she said, I have property in Italy, but I can't get the money here. She said, I would really love to be able to pay. And the nun said, wait 1 minute.
Uh-huh.
We have a Marymount in Rome. Is it possible to have someone bring the rents up to the Rome school? And she said, sure. And so my uncle used to collect the rents and used to bring them up twice a year up to Marymount in Rome. Marymount in Rome applied my tuition to Marymount Tarrytown. Now, I think technically, if you were to go through it, you would say, is that money washing or bringing money into the country illegally?
Sounds to me like and you were going
maybe,
to a multinational.
Maybe these two women, this nun and my mother, were both, you know, maybe they were guilty of bringing in money illegally into the country, doing it that way, but that's how my tuition was paid. And so I went not only to Marymount and Tarrytown for nothing, so that my mother really didn't have to pay anything at all. It was a cost saving for her. But I also went to their camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be at school from September to May, and then I'd go to camp July and August.
Weren't you a little lonely?
Oh, terribly.
But it's terribly. Obvious that also your mother felt that education was number one on her list of priorities. Your brother also.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And do you know what she used to say to me? She'd say to me, you see this place? Do you want to get out of the South Bronx? Where are you going to get out? Let's get an education.
Was that typical for Italian-American
no.
families?
No.
Especially people
Mm-mm.
from the Naples area?
No, because, I mean, let's go backwards. When she was graduating eighth grade, I mean, she had to go to work because she had younger brothers and sisters to support. Her father had had a stroke. And there's this tremendous pride. You know, my grandmother would not go on home relief. She took in sewing, but she sent her kids out to work. She would not take home leave. I mean, and to me, that's a little bit stupid. I mean, because it seems to me that if indeed she had taken home relief and my mother had been able to go to high school, her life would have been different, but it wasn't. So my mother recognized that. Now, my mother also didn't take any sort of assistance, but my mother understood that to get an education was important. And when I was 16, graduating from Marymount and Tarrytown, I had skipped a year, skipped seventh grade. When I was going to graduate, my mother was actually talking to my uncle and my grandmother about, you know, what I was going to do. And she said, you know, she's got scholarship to college, but I don't know whether or not, what I'm going to be able to do. And my uncle said to her, hey, Antoinette, you know, she's pretty. She'll get married. And I laugh when I tell the story and I say I was and I did.
But you want to be a nun at the time.
Well, it was what had happened was I was talking about entering the convent, but my mother wanted me to get an education. And she said to my uncle, she said, you know, if you educate a boy, you educate a boy alone. If you educate a girl, you educate a family. So my Jerry's going to go to college. So my mother was the one who pushed for this. I got the scholarship. We both were.
You went to Marymount.
Went to Marymount, 71st Street, right here.
No more money exchanging hands from
Italy. No more money exchanging hands. But what we did do was I got a scholarship, and then I went to work. I went to work part-time. My mother was working, and we were able to deal with this.
You obviously had a very strong Catholic upbringing, and yet in your politics, you've always been pro-choice. How have you reconciled the two?
Actually, if you take a look at my upbringing, where I am on virtually every other issue is very reflective of the Catholic upbringing that I have, whether it's taking care of the poor and the needy. I think my religion is a religion that really reaches out with compassion to people who need help, and I think government should also play that role. So that's one of the things that got me in trouble in 1984 when I turned around and I said that President Reagan's policies were very unchristian. They really are.
And yet, I think he got a very strong Catholic vote, didn't he? In fact,
the sense right now
is that the Catholic vote is moving very far into the conservative camp, whereas when it was an immigrant vote, it was strongly in the Democratic parties.
I would agree with you that it was becoming very conservative. I think this pendulum is moving back again to where people are recognizing. And let me just stop there. I think what happened with the ethnic vote, the Catholic vote, the immigrant vote, the children of immigrant vote, was that we came. You know, people came with nothing. My grandmother lived in an apartment and she had nine children plus one that she got from my grandfather because of the I should explain that. My grandmother was here with a maiden aunt when she was 15. Her maiden aunt died 8 months after she was here, died of malaria, believe it or not. And within weeks, she had to. The women who lived in the neighborhood said, "You can't live here at 15 years old without being married. This is not. You know, she had no choice. She couldn't go back to Italy." So they introduced her to this widower who was my grandfather, who had just lost his wife in childbirth. So she raised my Aunt Sarah and then raised nine of her own. She lived in an apartment with a toilet in the hall. I mean, I remember going to visit. You get that kind of an existence, and you get to the point where, you know, you're finally, your children or your grandchildren are succeeding, and they're succeeding because they've worked extremely hard. Those children and grandchildren sometimes forget that, in some instances, government did help, and that there are lots of other people who need the help. And so that's what you were getting with Reagan coming in and saying to these people, you know, let's not have government be there because perhaps government had gone too far.
You also see people who were discriminated against in previous generations mm-hmm. now saying keep the immigrants out because now they don't see themselves as the children or the grandchildren of immigrants. They see themselves as an American. And the next wave is as threatening to them as their grandparents were to the people who were here.
You know, in some ways, yes. I mean, what's happened over the years, I remember reading some of the stories and hearing my mother talk to me about how my grandfather was treated. He was treated like dirt. You know, he was an Italian. He spoke no English. Kids, when they went to school, Americanized their names. My mother was Antoinette. She became Anne or Anita. My Aunt Jenny was Joanine. She became Jenny. I mean, people, they Anglicanized, and they never spoke Italian except in the home. They never spoke it outside the home. Sometimes what you see what's happening now is unfortunate because we should know better as a nation. We've grown up. Those of us who are children of immigrants should reach out now a little bit more. But I think what you're finding with some of these policies with reference to the new immigrants, because the new immigrants are coming from Africa. They're coming from Central Latin America. They're coming from Asia. I mean, there's some obviously coming also from Eastern Europe now. But a lot of them are different colors. And so it's an anti-immigrant sentiment mixed in some instances with racist sentiment.
My guest on New York & Company is Geraldine A. Ferraro, who has written with Catherine Whitney a memoir called Framing a Life. It's published by Scribner's, and she will be reading and signing tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble store at 82nd Street and Broadway, that at 7:30. This is Radio New York, AM 820 WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. So were you a Democrat from the start? Was your family supporters of the party. How did you wind up going from all of this into electoral politics?
My family, the earliest elections I can remember was my mother and father going to polls and canceling each other out. My mother was a Republican, my father a Democrat. They used to argue about the issues. I can remember that as a child. After he died, she became a Democrat because here she was, somebody who was really a person who needed the Social Security system, person who needed the Medicare. Who put those things in place were Democrats. I was a voter. When I was in law school, I became involved with campaigns. But the reason I did was not for any idealistic viewpoint, I mean, to be quite frank, and not for any altruistic ideas. It really was simply because I knew I was going to law school at night. I was teaching during the day. I knew that when I came out as a woman, I was going to have a tough time getting a job. And in the law business, I was only one of two women in my class. So I joined a political club, figuring I'd be able to get some business or maybe a job or something then. Got involved, then stayed home for 13 years, raised my family, and became, got active in the Queens County Women's Bar. I actually ended up as president of it, and became active doing some work in the family court pro bono work on behalf of women. And when I went back to work in the DA's office, as a prosecutor, set up a bureau that implemented the battered spouse legislation in 1977. I did a whole bunch of things that really pushed me to the point where I was watching people coming through the system and was also watching the victims who were within the system and saying something has to be done about what's going on. That's why I ran for office.
And you had a meteoric rise. You were first elected to Congress in a district in Queens that you describe as Archie Bunker country. Mm. And within 6 years or so, you're running for vice president.
Incredible. Yeah, it was. It was meteoric. I've got to tell you that I'm the first one to say that had I been Gerard Ferraro in the Congress and not Geraldine, I would not have had that kind of a zooming career.
You also had the help of Tip O'Neill, who happened to like you, and
yeah,
he pushed you to the top.
I'm also rather aggressive. I get into a position, and I've done that with virtually every job I've ever held. Where I get in, I want to get things done. I want to, I did that when I was in the DA's office. I moved inside of 3 years. I was a supervising trial attorney. I was a bureau chief and created a bureau called the Special Victims Bureau. I did that in Congress. Inside of 2 years, I was in the House leadership. I like to move and take a position where I can get things done quickly. I've always been, I guess because my father died so suddenly. He died, he was having dinner with us on a Sunday night, was dead the next morning of a heart attack. I've always kind of felt that I've got to push everything as much as I can into the amount of time I have, because you never know how much time you have.
You also concerned that your mother see you succeed.
Yeah.
You say that your finest moment is when she, when you came back from the convention and she met you at the plane as the first woman vice presidential candidate, or in this case, my daughter, the vice presidential candidate.
She was so proud. And I got to tell you something. She was the only one who was not surprised that Walter Mondale asked me to be on the vice presidential ticket. And when I got the nomination, I called her up. She said, "Oh, I know you'll do a good job." But she was dead certain that I was going to get elected, because, mothers do have confidence in you. And she knew that if I had gotten elected, I would have been, an incredible vice president, according to my mother. Thank God for mothers' faith in their children.
Mm. Well, do you think you had a chance?
I don't think we had a chance when I got the nomination. We were 18 points behind. But I got to tell you something, when you go out and you talk to the crowds, and all of a sudden the crowds were as large as, the Secret Service said to me that the crowds were, they had not seen crowds that size since John F. Kennedy. I mean, that's how large the crowd, they were very emotional. People would come up and actually cry and talk about the future. I mean, they were filled with emotion. When you saw that, you say, hey, maybe something could happen.
And don't forget that the electoral vote isn't always a reflection of the popular vote. And you did fairly well in the popular vote. You just didn't do well in the electoral vote. So it looks like a landslide. But it's been 14 years since we've seen a woman nominated on any major party ticket. And there's talk now of a Bush-Dole ticket for 2000, George Bush and Elizabeth Dole. How do you feel about that?
I think it's great. I think there's also talk. I mean, people are talking about a Gore-Feinstein ticket. I mean, imagine if we had two tickets like that running against each other.
But wouldn't it even be better if it were Feinstein Gore or Dole Bush?
I would love it. The only thing is, in order to
happen
get...
happen everywhere. It's happened in India. It's happened in all sorts of countries
but let me
that
tell
aren't
you,
as
the difference is, the difference is this. In order to be elected in a parliamentary system, all you have to do is rise within your party. That's not that big a deal. And within our system, you have to be willing to run for president. Now, if Dianne Feinstein decides to challenge, you know, for this, we know Gore is going to run. Everybody knows that. Dianne gets in there and she's the winner of the presidential. Yes. I mean, that's for me. Liddy Dole and George Bush, there's talk about her running for president, too. She's going to have a tougher time because she's never held elective office. And she doesn't, what does she bring with her? What stay? What strength? Other than she's Liddy Dole. And that's good enough for me. But I think that it'll be wonderful to watching women run for office.
It's just amazing to imagine a Bush-Dole ticket, considering the fact that both the relatives were involved in national politics on the highest level. Well, what about looking back over this year? I'm sure it's something you've done a lot, and you ask yourself, what could I have done differently?
I could have stayed out of the race.
Well, some critics said you were relying too heavily on your celebrity, the name
that,
recognition.
That just isn't so. I must say that's one of the things that both Chuck and Mark's campaigns really spun very well. And I think the New York Times picked it up, and I think whether the Times goes, so does the rest of the
Well, that's
the
because
papers.
You started off with such a lead in the polls because of name recognition.
Yeah, it was. But the thing about it is it was more than name recognition because people knew, you know, what I stood for. I mean, there are people throughout the state that I've done things with. But, you know what, as I said to Chuck Schumer, I was really convinced that, and I said to him the day after the election we were chatting, I said to him, you know, if I had ever had a clue that he would have been able in November to wipe D'Amato's clock the way he did and beat him, I probably would not have gotten the campaign. I was just really hell-bent on making sure that Al D'Amato was not reelected. And in 1992, he had said that he believed that if I had gotten the nomination that I would have ended his career. And so I was still functioning on that level, still thinking that, you know, that I was the one who was going to be able to beat him. And because my strength was upstate New York, because my strength was in the Italian-American and Catholic ethnic groups.
To divide the Italian vote, that would have gone strongly for D'Amato otherwise.
Yeah, and what happened was the primary, I have not been able to get through a primary because neither in 92 nor now. And so getting through the primary is a tough thing. But I did say to Chuck, had I known that I would never have gotten in, and I'm delighted that he was able to beat, you know, D'Amato, and I'm delighted that he will now be representing the state in Washington.
You must have been surprised, as all of the experts were, that he wasn't so big. Why do you think they get it so wrong?
Because I think, again, they talk to each other. And I think that's part of it. Take a look, for instance, at the pundits. And Dick Morris, the day before this general election, actually the day of the general election, was predicting the Senate would lose, the Democrats would lose four seats, that it would go to 59 Republicans, and that the House, he figured, 20 to 30 seats. I mean, yeah, where do they get these numbers?
And these guys don't lose their jobs. They go on as experts the next day. You see them on television the next day, and they're explaining the next thing. Newt Gingrich now is being explained. Nobody predicted that.
And the thing about low voter turnout, for instance, in the primary, we had 15% low voter turnout. The people who turned out were not my supporters. They were Chuck supporters. If my folks had turned out, if Italians had turned out, if the African American community turned out, it might have been different results. But I mean, that's gone. In the general election, we still had a rather low turnout, but that benefited us because what we did with this time around was Chuck Schumer and the Democrats pulled the Democratic strength, whereas the Republicans this time in 1994, when Pataki was elected the first time, they pulled out people upstate New York in huge numbers, and people in New York City stayed home. The reverse was true this time around. Low voter turnout, but the voters that did turn out were Democrats downstate.
What do you think about the idea that the strong showing by the Democrats was a way of showing support for Clinton and rejecting Ken Starr and the whole impeachment process?
I think so. In some instances, I don't think New York State that was the basis of it. I think New York State loves Bill Clinton and Hillary, and Chuck was very smart to have them come in. But I think Chuck won because he talked about Democratic ideas. He talked about, I mean, I know in the primary, I mean, we focused on education and health care and Social Security, and I do know that he also talked about that as he went throughout the state. The ads on television were unfortunate, but, you know, he had no choice. He had to respond to them, the negatives.
D'Amato was suggesting that there would be a very negative campaign if you ran. There would be all sorts of talk about mob connections and your husband's real estate dealings and the like.
Well, I don't think D'Amato would have done that because he's got more of a problem than anybody else. But I mean, the thing about it is, could it have been any dirtier than it was? Any more negative? I mean, we were deluged with. God, 17 million from him and 12 million, 13 million from Chuck. I mean, it got really bad. And they went at each other over things that are unfortunate. The unfortunate thing about campaigns is that negative campaigning works. And this
And time, you would have had to have done it as well if you'd gotten the nomination.
Yeah, I would have focused. I think what he would have done was he would have quoted both Mark and Chuck on "She's floating on the fumes of fame and fortune. She hasn't done anything in the past 14 years. I mean, the fact that I had been ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Commission and Clinton appointee for 4 years and had done a tremendous amount of work in Geneva, as well as been the managing partner of a national law firm, you know, was kind of put down. I think that kind of thing would have been in the commercials. It would have attacked me personally. And, you know, for all, could have quoted the New York Times on some of this stuff. So I think it would have been a very personal negative campaign against me more than anything else.
Two more things. You are not going back to Crossfire, I mm-hmm. understand. Are you going to do other things?
I would have loved to have
like
gone
that?
Back, but my contract was terminated in January. I did not make the decision
They
to
keep
run.
On bringing back Pat Buchanan.
He created the show, so there's a little bit of an edge there. And they did sign a contract with Bill Press, so the Bill Press is on full time. But I'm looking around seeing maybe there's somebody else who wants me to do some television work.
Do you see any value in those things where the two sides yell at each other and everything always comes to a draw?
You didn't watch it when I was on. We never yelled at each other. We tried to keep it civil. But the thing about it is, yeah, I do think it was that show is done not only to inform, but it's also to entertain. I mean, you know, in a way, it gives people an opportunity to meet their representatives, which I think is important, and to discuss some of the issues. I mean, we had, for a good period of time when I was on, we did O.J. Simpson until it was coming out of everybody's ears, forehead, and all over the place. It was just horrendous. But it was fun to do, and it was as much entertainment as it was anything else.
Well, maybe you were spared not having to do he's going to quit today, he's going to quit tomorrow, he's going to resign, he's going to be forced to quit, he's going to be impeached. The other thing is you closed your restaurant, Cascabel, just
yes.
a few blocks away from where we are now.
Yeah, that actually is my son's restaurant, and it was
I know
was
you
a
were
great,
there a lot.
I was there a lot. I liked the food. It was excellent. One of the chefs that we had is now up at Tavern on the Green, Sam Hazen, and he's really superb.
And the guy before him has his own restaurant uptown.
Yeah, everybody has moved. I mean, the thing about it is, it's a business that you really have to be there at. My son is a lawyer, so he wasn't there all the time. And if you don't run it yourself, the expenses get too high and you end up losing money. So it was a nice venture. We loved doing it. I loved eating there, but we're on to bigger and better things.
Geraldine A. Ferraro has written a memoir, a family memoir, called Framing a Life with the help of Catherine Whitty.
Who's wonderful,
Whitney,
by the way.
It is published by Scribner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.